Online Trading Academy's core strategy is patented and built on the timeless principles of supply and demand. Text Cairo to 57682 to learn how you can trade stocks using this patented core strategy. Text Cairo to 57682.
Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in today. Happy to be here. Happy Tuesday, everybody. There's a few sun breaks out there to keep you smiling if you look out your window at your place of business, as I am right now, and it looks gray. So I jumped the gun on that one a little bit. Let's not waste any time. Let's get right into the fastest 15 today. Lots of stories to cover. So there's a D.C. council member that's introduced legislation that would lower the age to vote in federal and local elections to the age of 16. Before I give my take on this, Zach, how does that hit your ears?
Well, I know what this council person is doing. They're capitalizing on the Parkland High School students,
absolutely,
right? Who have been steering the conversation largely on gun control over the past month or so. So trying to get some good press. This is a bill that everyone would feel good about it. 18, it has been this kind of arbitrary number when it comes to a lot of rights here in the United States. Here's why I support it, or why I really can't come out strongly against it, is that adults aren't doing that great of a job when it comes to voter turnout as it is, you know, or when it comes to informing ourselves as voters. Many of us are single-issue voters. Many of us just buy into the cult of personality. You know what? I like this person. I don't like this person. Always one of the most popular poll questions is, would you want to have a beer with them? And a lot of people make their decisions based on that. And if you go and vote, no matter what the reason, good on you. But can we actually say that we hold the vote so preciously that we can't afford to give it to someone 2 years younger than the current voter is right now? And here's the other reason I would support it. If you are a 16-year-old who chooses to vote, odds are you are quite civically engaged. You have been talking about it in school. This is interesting to you. You have been studying the issues inside and outside of the classroom. So I would imagine a lot of these 16-year-old voters, immature as they may be, will be a lot more informed than the mid-30s voter like myself, the mid-40s voter who turned out to the polls.
And look, 7 of the 13 members of the D.C. Council are actually backing the measure, to your point. I think it's a horrible idea, but I like that we are talking about it and the reasons for why the voting age is what it is. And really, this goes back to the founding of our country. Debate about who can vote and what minimum age you have to be to vote goes back to James Madison, George Washington, and all those guys debating about what kind of country they wanted. And the original discussion was about whether property owners can vote and people who didn't own property can vote. So there's no black and white answer necessarily.
Well, there was then.
Nice. Oh, I see what you did there, Zach. Nicely done. But around the time of World War II, the voting age was 21. But it turns out you could serve in the military at 18, and public sentiment began to shift. And in 1971, Richard Nixon signed into law the 26th Amendment, which made it legal for anyone 18 years or older to vote. So it's arbitrary in a sense. And at the same time, why I think it's problematic to lower the age even more is because we live in an age of perpetual adolescence, where we want to prolong childhood for as long as possible. You see that we're getting married much later in life, having kids much later in life, and we want to stay kids forever. There's some kind of allure or, you know, drive for people to want to, oh, child, I'm playing adult today. I'm playing adult. You're not an actual adult. You're adulting. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a verb.
Can I pause you on that for a second?
Let me finish this one point. Life experiences change a person dramatically, okay? And they bring wisdom into one's life, not just knowledge. So kids, their minds are sponges and they get a lot of information. But the only thing that really brings wisdom is living through life. And when you're 16, most people generally have really not experienced a lot. They've never held a long-term job. They've never had to pay taxes. You think having to pay taxes might affect your political views? Hell yes. You've never been married. You've never had kids. You've never, you know, there are so many things vital to being able to.
But most 18-year-olds have done all this.
I would be in favor of making it 19 or 20 because I think we
are. How about
are,
not until you're married and have kids?
That's what I'm saying. There's no black and white answer, Zach. But I think the trend of wanting to make it younger is a negative trend. Mm-hmm. If anything, I would like to see it go in the direction of making people who are older and have lived more life's experiences to be able to cast a vote, to potentially bring someone into office that can affect the lives of all their constituents.
Can I go through just a few of your points?
Please do.
Let's first talk about the issue of taxation. We're $21 trillion in debt. That's the adult's fault.
And you think children would do a lot better with that?
Oh, they couldn't really do worse. Could they, Greg? We have now a party in place that's supposed to be the party of fiscal responsibility, and we've already added $1 trillion in debt, okay?
And there was $9 trillion under Obama.
I get
sure.
That was a recession time. That was the end of a war time, too. There was
extra
spending, but whatever.
Go ahead.
Then you talk about life experiences, married, having kids. I'm married. I don't have children. I don't have that experience yet.
Yeah.
I kind of object to you correlating that with me wanting to preserve my childhood. Now, we all want to preserve our youth. We all want to remain young at heart for as long as possible. I thought, actually, it was the adult move. It was the grown-up move for me to put off having children until I found myself in a place where I could be absolutely sure that I could take care of them financially.
Okay.
I hadn't found myself in that place in my 20s. In my early 30s, I struggled post-2008 recession. I'm getting to a place now, and now we're seriously having conversations. That felt very, very adult to me. That was the grown-up thing to do. And to take away these kids' voices just because they lack the quote-unquote wisdom, I don't know, Greg. I look to my elders, and you're supposed to absorb this wisdom after a certain amount of years on this planet. I don't know if that phrase actually is proving to be true, because I think what you do as you get older is you start to get stubborn, and then you look for opinions that are exactly
hardened,
like your own, just to confirm that your view of the world. I know that's what I'm becoming.
Hopefully, I would say hopefully. When you grow up, you learn how to process things and use your common sense and be reasonable and take a pause and consider all the evidence. I would say we're shifting more and more to a place where we don't do that. But children, look, when I was 16, Zach, I thought I was going to marry Britney Spears. I should not have been given the right to vote. I had delusions of grandeur. I had hormones that were raging. I was not in a place to study the positions of my politicians who are running for high office and really make an educated, reasonable, non-emotional decision. And I'm not saying adults always do that. I'm saying you have a better chance of that with adults.
Didn't emotion, I mean, that was the genius of Trump, is that he tapped into the pure emotion, the pure anger of this country. And that's what compelled so many people to go out and vote for him. That's what I always applauded him for. Good for you. People are angry, and you're saying, instead of saying, no, dummies, don't be angry, we got this. He said, no, you're angry, I'm angry too. And if you're a 16-year-old who only is thinking about Britney Spears or whoever the girl of the moment is.
Hold on, I want to take a moment to think about her again.
Yeah, it was a good era.
And that was some good times.
Then you're probably not going to take the day off of school and go vote. I think what it's going to be is for the kids who are really civically engaged. I was one of those kids in 16, thanks to my history teacher, Mr. Moore. I think I probably studied more current day-to-day political issues in high school than almost at any other point in my life before I got into radio, before I got into this career.
I'll just end this first story in the Fastest 15 this way. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. Mm-hmm. When I became a man, I put away childish things. All right, let's get on to the next story in the Fastest 15. What's your take on Bill Maher? I watched his real-time program last Friday, and I typically try to catch it every week because I find his panel discussions very interesting, and I like the debate, and I like the fact that he has conservatives on the show, and he's willing to spar with them. And did you watch this last Friday show?
I usually don't miss an episode.
You have a love-hate relationship with him, right? Or just hate-hate?
No, I don't hate him.
Yeah.
I just find he's becoming increasingly predictable.
Stale.
In that he is always the contrarian, right? Okay, everyone thinks I'm going to go this way, or the current zeitgeist in America right now is this way, so I'm going to go this way. I'll commend him for his entire career. I think that anybody who has been through what he's been through in terms of protecting free speech, I will stand up and applaud for you. But at this point, I feel like he's just kind of become a caricature of himself, which, you know, for so many people, especially with a show like Real Time, where it's supposed to be provocative, that's kind of what he's become. Yet, every Friday or Saturday morning,
you tune in.
It's in my DVR.
Right. And at the very end of his show on Friday, there was a great segment. He always does his New Rules segment. But at the very end, he spends 3 or 4 minutes expanding on one of his new rules. And this time, the focus of his monologue was this idea of cultural trends and cultural shifts and the idea that we evolve as societies. And the subject of the monologue was Molly Ringwald had written a piece. I think it appeared in The New Yorker. And it was correct. About how in the context of the Me Too movement, watching Breakfast Club with her daughter really disturbed her because of how far we've come as a society and how regressive some of the ideas were in that 1980s John Hughes movie. Here's what Bill Maher had to say about that.
And finally, new rule, enough with revisiting things. Stop being surprised every time you watch an old movie or TV show and find some of the ideas in it are old. A recent article by Molly Ringwald got a lot of attention because she revisited The Breakfast Club and her other 80s movies and found them troubling in the age of Me Too. She said she was taken aback by the scope of the ugliness. Oh, please, they were teen comedies, not snuff films. She said, it's hard for me to understand how John Hughes was able to write with so much sensitivity and also have such a glaring blind spot. Oh, I don't know. Should we dig him up and yell at him? You can't blame someone for not being woke 30 years before woke was a thing.
I think that's a very shrewd observation.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get to that last clip, do you agree with him?
I don't think there's any reason to not watch those films because of some of the content.
But you've watched some older things and cringed at times. And
yeah.
Like, whoa,
I mean,
how did that make it
another John Hughes
film?
Movie, 16 Candles, is way worse than The Breakfast Club.
Try watching Caddyshack and just like the objectification of women and just all these like horny young men wanting to see naked women.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, that existed.
Well, even beyond, in 16 Candles, I'm going to go to another John Hughes movie. One of the main protagonists, Anthony Michael Hall, has sex with a girl while she's passed out. Then there's another character named Long Duck Dong, who is played by the most stereotypical Asian actor you've ever seen. Is this a reason not to go back and watch these movies? No, but to cringe at them, being that you live now in 2018,
yeah.
I think is the appropriate response.
Here was Bill Maher's broader point, which I actually think is spot on, and I want to point out why it's so spot on.
In the early 1900s, heroin was a children's cough medicine. In the 50s, amphetamines were sold to housewives as diet pills. We used to drive without seat belts and drink while we were pregnant and litter indiscriminately, just throw out the window.
Here comes his strongest point, in my opinion.
We smoked on airplanes. We would board an enclosed aluminum tube with old people and children and asthmatics and light up a Chesterfield. We had pageants where we paraded women in swimsuits and judged them on their appearance. Oh, wait, we still do that. Yes. Yes. And that's the point. We're never finished evolving. I hate to break it to you, but no matter how woke you think you are tolerating things right now that will make you cringe in 25 years.
Here's what I have to say about that, Zach.
Mm-hmm.
I think he is articulating one of the primary inherent problems of cultural relativism. And that is that values are always changing in this mode of thinking. They shift with the wind. They're susceptible to our feelings and our sensitivities that evolve or possibly regress. So this is more proof to me that a person needs a set of values in their life that don't change, that are timeless, that can remain true throughout one's life. Because there's an assumption he makes there, and that is we're always evolving. And he is sort of meaning that in a way to say we're evolving in the right direction. That's not necessarily true. Sometimes we evolve in a regressive direction. If you were alive in 1930s Germany and you believed, well, we're just always evolving. We're always advancing. We're always going in the right direction. And Hitler ascends to power. He was duly elected. You would think, oh, wow. And then now you look at that in context, you're like, what a backwards way of thinking. But if you were alive at the time, you would have thought, we're evolving. We're going in the right direction.
And the only thing that fixes that is more time.
And to be able to gain perspective, exactly.
How do we study our evolution if we don't look to the past? How do we know we're evolving unless we look back to all the things that Bill Maher mentioned and realize, wow, it is kind of incredible what we used to tolerate. We used to have the Flintstones doing cigarette commercials.
You know who always used to think that certain parts of the Breakfast Club and 16 Candles were abhorrent and wrong? People who've always believed in traditional family values. That might sound insane to you, but I remember, I grew up in a conservative Christian household, and when I would see those rom-coms of the 80s, I would go, oh, they're really objectifying Molly Ringwald. This is wrong. It didn't take the Me Too movement for me to wake up to that fact. I thought that for 30 years, and now everybody's getting woke, and the woke thing is to have like this higher standard of morality and not exploiting women. I'm like,
what's wrong with that? I mean, if people are still late to the party, they still arrived.
Great point. I completely concur with you, but I am very thankful for having a set of values that have been time-tested over some 2,000 years. And I think, yes, there's been moments of hypocrisy that people who hold traditional family values and stuff, but do you agree with my point about how cultural relativism, there are a few pitfalls to it?
Of course there are.
Okay.
Yes.
There's
no philosophy without pitfalls. Every single one has one.
Right.
Yeah, so there definitely is here, but for one of the actresses who actually participated, and there's a scene where, you know, I want to say Judd Nelson. Mm-hmm. Judd Nelson actually like crawls under a desk and looks up her skirt, right?
Yes.
That scene happens.
Right.
In the time, because it was John Hughes, who didn't love John Hughes in that era, and because it was under the guise of this coming of age comedy drama, in that moment, Molly Ringwald, I don't think, realized the gravity of that scene or what that scene might have said to young girls who watched it, who thought that was just a boy being playful. It took her a while to get there, but she got there. And I think that she probably got there before she wrote this editorial. But this is the first time that she's going public, actually critiquing and reviewing some of the work that she participated in that led to a culture that has now created this Me Too movement. And I think that I can only see that as a positive thing. Does it mean that you should not watch The Breakfast Club? I could argue 1,000 other reasons that you shouldn't watch The Breakfast Club. It's a horrendous movie. It's, as an adult, it's terrible. It's if you like that, you probably still read Catcher in the Rye. I think it's brilliant literature.
Do you still have all the beliefs you had when you were 18?
No, of course not.
And do you think you'll have the same beliefs now that you'll have when you're 55?
But again, beliefs, and then there's core beliefs, right? There's beliefs like, oh, this causes this, and then someone can issue a report or a study, and then I can change my mind. But there, you know, as you mentioned, there's those family values. I had family values instilled in me by primarily my mother, but also my father.
Mm-hmm.
But even me having those values, realizing that what Judd Nelson did in that movie is something I would never do, I didn't recognize what was objectionable about that scene watching it for the first time as an 8-9-year-old boy. And she probably didn't realize, or she was coerced to go along because, again, it was a John Hughes movie, into acting in that scene. So condemning the past or disavowing the past, you can do that if you want, but I think reevaluating some of the things that we once accepted as just being okay in the mainstream, it's always good to look back at what we've done.
Completely agree that it's always good to look back and gain perspective, and let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's celebrate what was once and always good and get rid of something that is, yeah, we've moved on from that.
Okay.
It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns filling in for Dory Monson today. Coming up, I'm really excited about this next interview. We're going to welcome world-renowned magician David Blaine, who's coming to Seattle soon. Coming up next.
Ho, 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 it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so.
All right, our next guest is a world-renowned magician who's made a very successful career out of the blending of magic and stunt work. He really breathed new life into a field that many believed had gone stale over some decades. He's bringing his one-man show to the Paramount Theater here in Seattle on Wednesday, May 16th. The eponymous David Blaine Live Show is the name of the national tour, and David Blaine joins us now. David, thanks for making the time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Greg. How's it going, Zach?
David, is there anybody in your life that knows all the tricks to all of your illusions?
I mean, I think no.
No?
Actually, no, because there's so many different pieces of what I do. So I don't think there's anybody that specifically has all the concepts figured out. And I think what's interesting about magic is even if you think you have the concept figured out and it's wrong, it still satisfies that part of the brain. It says, oh, I know how he's doing that. But often the method, you know, there's usually so many different variations and stuff like that.
So tell us about this new show that you're taking on the road. Is it all new material? Are there some, you know, so-called greatest hits, or what's the format?
It's a combination of that. So it's like my favorite things of endurance feats, my favorite pieces of magic. It's new pieces of magic, and they're all combined live on a stage. And, you know, it makes for a show that any night anything can happen, anything can go wrong. It's not a prepackaged idea. And it's not an illusion show. What you're seeing is you know, night after night, an event of a bunch of endurance feats where anything could stop the show. And combined with the audience being brought up and interaction and participation, there is an unknown in every single night. It's exciting. It's fun for me night after night. But it is very difficult physically, and I am pushing myself harder than I ever have for any of my endurance feats, because this is night after night after night after night after night. Every show I can't eat, every day I can't eat, and you know, you come in with low energy, and I go into the audience, sometimes into the balcony, to get myself started, buzzed up, and ready to go, and then I jump on stage and begin this combination of endurance and magic.
David, why can't you eat?
I can't eat because there's a couple of tricks in the show, like the human aquarium, where I put a gallon of water in my stomach and creatures could live inside, and you can put objects in your stomach, so you can't have any food in there, obviously, because you can't have any acid. So the stomach has to be used as just a container for a gallon of water. And then on top of that, I do the kerosene, where I put it in my mouth, spit it out, light the fire, sometimes swallow it, and then extinguish the fire, so you wouldn't want that to be anything but clear water. So therefore, every single day of a show, I don't eat for 24 hours before, which means if you have two shows or three shows back-to-back, it means you don't eat for 3 days. So therefore, you're coming in with very low energy. So in order to kick through that, I usually jump up into the balcony before the show begins and do the old street-style magic stuff that I do, get excited, then I go on stage charged.
So in your career, you've swam with sharks, you've done a bullet catch, you've been encased in a massive block of ice for 3 days, you've done various endurance tests, one of which you were standing atop a 22-foot high pillar in New York City, and coils were directing 1 million volts at you. What's the most difficult or scary stunt you've ever pulled, and would you do it again?
I think the most difficult endurance stunt that I've ever is going to be this tour. Because, like I said, the combination of all these things back-to-back, night after night, including the breath hold every single night, which I couldn't even get an insurance company to cover because they think the risk is too high. So this is probably my greatest and most difficult challenge to date.
David, I don't know if you've ever seen any early videos of Lady Gaga when she was just Stephanie Germanotta. She was just a musician. She hadn't developed her persona yet. If we were to find early videos of David Blaine before he came David Blaine, what would we be in for?
Yeah, I'm still hammering nails into my nose and doing these ridiculous things when I was a kid. So yeah, I was still trying to do things in magic that were different than what was out there and focused more on the believability of it and stuff like that. So I was always intrigued by that.
What did you develop first, the tricks or the persona? Which is more important for a young magician?
That's a good question. I think for me, it was first I just started with tricks. I was learning how to hold my breath because I had to keep up with the kids swimming on the swim team, and I had my feet were turned in as a child growing up, so I had braces on, so I couldn't swim as fast. So I'd swim laps while not breathing, and, you know, as a kid, you find out that Houdini would do those types of things, so you think that you're pushing yourself and creating. But there was another part of me that was also just doing card tricks, and I think, you know, after doing it over and over, I started to realize that less is more. So I started to think if a real magician existed, he wouldn't really step over. He would just do something, and then the people would process whatever they wanted. So that was the development of the persona, was just basically following what I already felt I was. But when I was a kid, people used to say, oh, you talk so slow. I used to get made fun of for that type of thing. But, you know, eventually it just, you know, when you're doing magic, it's kind of better to be slow because it's not about speed and misdirection. When they think that they're watching everything and then magic is happening, they can't really process what's going on. So I think it all works together as you put countless hours of practice and failure and repetition into something, and eventually you develop your persona, I guess.
We're speaking with one of the most popular magicians in the world, David Blaine. He's bringing his one-man show, David Blaine Live, to the Paramount Theater on Wednesday, May 16th. Tickets are still available at Ticketmaster.com. David, I've seen lots of interviews with you over the years, and if I'm being honest, it's hard to distinguish where Dave Blaine, the performer, ends and where David Blaine, the regular guy, begins. I mean, do you think of your onstage persona as a character? And if so, does that ever get turned off?
Completely, change. Yeah, I think it will change your opinion, because all of my friends, they're always like, yeah, the TV show never really shows who you are. But on stage, it kind of shows that there's a sense of humor, and it's a whole different point of view. Because when I'm doing a TV show, I'm not like a comedian, so I'm not the funniest guy. So that part of it I eliminate. So I let the comedy be the reactions of the audience. But on stage, you kind of see that, you know, the characteristics that are not filtered out or edited out. You see the whole thing live, and I guess you get a glimpse into the personality as opposed to just the reactions of the people combined with the tricks.
So does this Sunday afternoon ever exist for David Blaine? Just hanging out with some friends, watching TV or football or something like that?
Having a few Bud Lights?
Yeah, of course that exists. I just happen to always have a deck of cards in my hands, and during commercial breaks I'm practicing new things.
I want to ask you a question sort of outside the box a little bit here, because I've seen lots of videos where people are in your presence and you're performing magic up close for people. And honestly, it unsettles individuals who see it. And they almost believe that there's like a spiritual aspect to what they're witnessing.
The devil.
Yes, honestly. And so, David, I want to ask you point blank, in all seriousness, are you a person that actually believes in sort of the paranormal or spiritual forces at play? And do you gravitate towards any type of religious faith of any kind? Because I think people think
really,
of those things.
Those are really great questions. Yeah. By the way, there's a lot of questions in one on that, but I'm going to go through all of the pieces again, starting with religion. So my mother used to believe that, you know, that religions are like trails up a mountain that all lead to the same peak. So if you and I like the Abraham Lincoln quote where he says, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. And that's my religion. So I do believe in God, and I do believe in a force that's greater than ourselves. But at the same time, magic is very simple. You know, it's very simple. It's just practice, training, and, you know, failing and rehearsing combined with psychology and intuition, which makes, for me, magic more than just tricks. It brings it to a whole different personal level. Now, the next part of the question that you asked, I guess, is, and I don't want to write off, like, is there paranormal? I'm not one to say yes or no, because I also believe that there's some part of us that we can't explain where, you know, I'll think of somebody I haven't spoken to in 20 years, and then my phone will ring immediately from that person. So to me, that's not just coincidental, because it happens too often. So I think there is a part of brain waves that we don't understand, and how fast they travel and how they intersect with each other. So currently that would be looked at as magic. But then again, 1,000 years ago, the idea of being able to speak to anybody on a phone in any part of the world, or on the other side of the world, or even on the moon, being able to communicate through a satellite communication seemed like magic, but now it's all real. So, you know, as far as that goes, I don't think we have control over the paranormal things that you're talking about, but I do think that those possibilities are out there, but they're all explainable by science.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, David, because I was just thinking the other day, I wonder how David Blaine's doing, and then all of a sudden this interview gets scheduled. David,
well,
the beginning of this interview, I asked you if anybody else knew all the secrets behind your tricks, and it seems like you're the only person who, from the beginning to the end of your show, knows what's going to happen and how it happens. Is that a thrilling experience, being the only one on the planet who knows that, or is it lonely?
I don't know what's going to happen, by the way.
Okay, but when you do, like, let's take your street magic, for example. Obviously, you're stunt. You don't know if 100% of the time you're going to succeed. But with the tricks that you're doing on the street, you have to be pretty much 100% sure at this point.
Nope.
So is there hours of footage of disappointed crowds leaving?
No. But here's the thing. That's a good question as well. That's a very good question. See, you're lucky as a magician, because, like you said, nobody knows the secrets. Means nobody knows where you're going. So trick doesn't really end until you decide that it's over. So it could be going in one direction. It could be going completely wrong. But that doesn't matter, because as long as you keep going, eventually you'll resolve it with an ending that works for you. So the majority of the case is, because magic is kind of, not really explain it. There's no direction for it because a trick doesn't have an exact beginning, middle, and overall, at least the ones that I do, it can constantly change. So it is always alive and it is always different. As long as you keep going for an outcome that you're used to, which is, you know, doing something that doesn't make sense, then eventually you'll get there.
David Blaine live at the Paramount Theater here in Seattle, Wednesday, May 16th. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. David, thank you so much for the time. Looking forward to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Dory Monson Show podcast, brought to you by Industrious Office. Industrious Office is just an amazing workspace right in the heart of downtown Seattle, right on 6th and Lenora, right where everything Seattle has to offer is on your doorstep. And at Industrious, you can start with the right size office and then scale up as your team grows. Go to industriousoffice.com/Cairo, schedule a tour, mention Cairo, receive your first month lease for free.
Hi, I'm Tina Sorensen, General Sales Manager for Cairo Radio. When Cairo Radio listeners miss their favorite show, they find it on demand. Maybe you should be advertising here. Give me a call and I'll help you out. 206-726-6819.
Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns sitting in for Dory Monson today. Yesterday on the show, we told you about the death of actor R. Lee Ermey, who passed away in his mid-70s. He was known for all these gritty, no-nonsense military roles on film, including being the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket. Today, we got the news of another sad death of an actor, Harry Anderson, at the age of 65. You might not know the name, but you would recognize his face. Why is that, Zach?
Because you probably saw one of the 193 episodes of Night Court that aired on NBC. And if you missed those, he had another 98 episodes of Dave's World, totaling almost 300 episodes of sitcom stardom. And before that, he was, you know, we just spoke to David Blaine. He got his start as a magician. He's actually was a very well-respected magician. Early on in the early days, early 80s of Saturday Night Live, they used to bring him on the show, not to be in any of the sketches, but to simply come on and do a magic trick. Hmm. Something I didn't learn about before a couple of weeks ago. It's kind of hard to find him actually doing his magic tricks, unless you go to Amazon, of course. But you can't get it on DVD. If you want the magic of Harry Anderson, you have to get it on VHS.
And 65 years old just seems so young.
Yeah.
So, I was never really akin to Night Court, because I think its main run was 82 to 89 or something along those lines. So I was like 7 years old, right in its prime. I wasn't exactly staying up late to watch it. And by the time I became 14, 15, it was aired like late in the night on USA Network or something like that. What was the main premise of the show, and why did it have such staying power?
It was Night Court. It was Court
it's
and Night.
That it's
very
iconic. It's a,
because
okay.
Just great characters. You had Bull. You had John Larroquette as Dan Fielding, who won Emmys for that. Harry Anderson was just a great comic presence. Marky Post. The reason I got into it is there was two shows I wasn't allowed to watch. Night Court was one of them. Yes. So anytime I could sneak off an episode, I definitely tried.
It's Greg Tomlin and Zach Burns in for Dory Monson today. Stick around. We got the big lead coming up. Thanks for being here.